Well, before teaching started this year, we have to go through training. Megan, I know, went through the same stuff we do. And it's all about the issues that we're going to face in classrooms and how to handle certain situations. And found out there are 4 new diagnoses, if you will, for different disorders that children have in the last 2 years that allows them to act in certain ways that we would have had our little tails beaten when we grew up, and it seemed to take care of that, but apparently that's not the case anymore. So I was thinking all week, what's the problem? And I think we know what the problem is, but I found a book written by a lady named Marguerite Lamb. She's a clinical psychologist, and she wrote a book called 7 Secrets to Raising a Happy Child. And I looked at her for her 7 points here, and today I'd like to tie those into with the Bible, because each one of these you can certainly find verses that do back up what she says here. Now, first off, what is a family? I looked up in Webster's, there were several different definitions, but the first one says it's a group consisting of parents and children living together in a household. And I wonder a few years ago if that would have been a group consisting of mother and father and children living together. It's very possible they've changed that wording just a little bit to fit today's society. But we need a strong household. Now, how do we build a strong household? We know the secrets to it. God gave us this family plan to fit in with what His future plans are for us. But how do we build a strong household? I'd like to look at Matthew 7, if you will. Matthew 7 is talking about the foundations. Matthew 7, verses 24 through 27. It says, "Therefore, whoever hears these sayings of mine and does them, I will liken him to a wise man who built his house on the rock. And the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it did not fall, for it was founded on the rock. But everyone who hears these sayings of mine and does not do them will be like a foolish man who built his house on the sand, and the rain descended, the floods came, and the winds blew and beat on that house, and it fell, and great was its fall." A strong family does have this solid foundation. There is that platform to build on. According to the Brookings Institute, 37% of all children born in the United States are born out of wedlock today. That's well over 1/3 of all children born out of wedlock today. Is there any wonder we have poverty? You've got single mothers raising children all over the place, and you see the children. We have a very low at Rockville, well, considering the rest of the county, a very low free lunch percentage, and it's at 32%. And we're considered one of the very, very low free and reduced lunch schools in the county. It fits right in with this 1/3 of all children born. I mean, single mothers having to raise children and provide for them. We're going to constantly have this problem. Wealthiest nation in the world, and we're still faced with this. Well, this is directly, we don't have that solid foundation that God talks about. If you don't think we have these problems, go visit one of these schools for a day. Go walk into one of these schools and look at the issues that we have. And it's getting worse and worse every year. But I'd like to look at 7 points today that gives us that opportunity to build a strong base for our family. We get to go to the feast in a week. A lot of us get to spend time with family that we don't normally get to. And it's a way to also build that foundation while we're there. Not just all the time, but at the feast we get a lot more time than we typically do because we're all busy in this world of working 60, 70 hours a week and barely seeing each other. But the first point that this lady had was she said, to raise a happy child, you have to build connections. First point is to build connections. And after each point, I'm going to read a little bit about what she says. She says, the surest way to promote your child's lifelong emotional well-being is to help him feel connected to you, other family members, friends, neighbors, daycare providers, even to pets. A connected childhood is the key to happiness, says Edward Hollowell, MD, author of The Childhood Roots of Adult Happiness. He points as evidence to the National Longitude Study of Adolescent Health, and this involves some 90,000 teens, in which a feeling of being loved, understood, wanted, and acknowledged emerged as by far the biggest protector against emotional distress, suicidal thoughts, and risky behaviors including smoking, drinking, and using drugs. We've got to make our own families and our own children feel connected and loved. Video games and social media, those should never be babysitters for our children. And those should not be the ways that they connect to people. Social media is, a lot of that's turning into disasters right now, with kids not knowing how to connect to one another, with things that are being said over the internet. We need to be more connected with our own children. Let's look at Deuteronomy 6 and see what God says about this. Deuteronomy 6. Deuteronomy 6 and verses 6 and 7. We've seen this. It's very well known, especially in the church. It said, and these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children and shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, and when you rise up. Now, it's talking about teaching children God's way, but it's also saying something else. Look at when it says you're teaching. When you wake up, when you sit in your house, when you walk, when you lie down, when you rise up, you're not teaching them if they're not there, right? So everything he's saying here is saying not only teaching God's way, but you're spending that time. You're building that connection to your family. It seems difficult to do that. We've got everyone's going every which way today, and it's very hard to build those connections. But according to this scripture, we are not only to teach them God's way, but we're spending that time together as well. When I was growing up, we would run out of wood in February every year. Every single year we would run out of wood, and it would be, of course, the coldest Sunday every year that we would be back in the woods cutting woods. Dad would cut the wood, I would put it on the wagon, we would take it. Oh, I hated those days. Miserable. Your fingers, I bit my fingers so they were tender anyway, and it felt like they were going to fall off. But I spent time with my dad there that I wouldn't have if we didn't have that time. And I could say I wouldn't trade that for anything in the world today. That just those connections that we made. Dad taught me something about work there that possibly if we had lived somewhere where we didn't have to rely on that, I wouldn't have. And just that time spent together is so important. Whether they appreciate it or not, they're certainly going to later. Every chance you get, build those connections and build that relationship. Second point, seems kind of strange, but the second point does make sense. Don't try to make your child happy. Doesn't mean beat them and torture them, put them in something. But don't try to make your child happy. Here's what she says. It sounds counterintuitive, but the best thing you can do for your child's long-term happiness may be to stop trying to keep him or her happy in the short term. If we put our kids in a bubble and grant them their every wish and desire, that is what they grow to expect. But the real world doesn't work that way. The real world doesn't work that way. That's absolutely true. Absolutely true. Let's go to Proverbs 30 and see what God says about this. How many children do we see that have everything in the world, and then the first time something goes wrong, they don't know how to handle it? Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9. It's about, and my dad always had a saying, I think he learned it from an older man that lived with us when I was real little. He said, if you want to ruin someone, give them more than they can handle. But Proverbs 30, verses 8 and 9 says, keep falsehood and lies far from me. Give me neither poverty nor riches, but give me only my daily bread. Otherwise, I may have too much and disown you and say, who is the Lord? Or I may become poor and steal, and so dishonor the name of my God. We've all heard those stories, and we've seen those stories where a child was given everything, and it ends in disaster, or it ends with them really having to take some hard knocks because of never learning to fail. Last year, Logan called, I don't know if he texted us, I think he called us one night, and he was driving down Memorial Boulevard, and Nevlin works right on Memorial between Sportscom and the VA, and he said there was a car, he couldn't really tell what it was, so it was a black car. And he said, Dad, it's in the tree about 70, 80 feet from the road. It was wrapped around the tree. And, of course, that made us interesting. He said, there's no way they live. So there's police everywhere. They're flagging it off and everything. And so the next day, Neville and I happened to be driving by, and there was a family there. You could tell they were just devastated. They were standing by the tree, and it was obvious that they had lost someone. So I wondered who it was, so I started watching the next couple of days in the Daily News Journal, and there was a story about a 17-year-old boy, I think he went to Siegel, and he was a junior, and he had naturally been killed in a car wreck, and his mother, they interviewed her, and it shocked me, and I hate to say it because I know they were hurting, but it honestly disgusted me. Because what she talked about, oh, from the time he was a little baby, he loved fast cars. He couldn't wait to get in a car and see how fast he could go. He was doing 120 miles an hour down Memorial in Murfreesboro. And his mother talked about how they loved when they could buy him that car. And I thought, you bought a kid who wants to drive fast a Ford Mustang. You give them too much, it can end in disaster. And I'm sorry for the family, but my kid's going to get a one-cylinder Fred Flintstone vehicle if they want to go 120 miles an hour. You don't give our kids stuff when we know how it can end, do we? There are times when we have to discipline our children. You don't even need to turn there because I know I'm going to run a little bit long today. For me, that still won't be over. But there are times when we have to discipline our children. Proverbs 13:24. And Michael, Keith, and I have talked about this verse, and we love this verse. Our kids don't. We hated it when we were younger. Proverbs 13:24 says, he who spares his rod hates his son, but he who loves him disciplines him promptly. And I've told my kids that a lot. They didn't like that when they were a little bit younger. But this doesn't mean beating them half to death. This means we're trying to keep them on this straight and narrow path. The same way when they get a little older, you tell a teenager, don't do that. Because we've been through it, haven't we? We've all made those mistakes. The only reason we're disciplining is we don't want them to make those same mistakes that we did. We've all made our own mistakes, and we don't want them to repeat them. So we're trying to keep them from a rough life, from wrapping yourself around a tree at 120 miles an hour. We're trying to prevent that from happening with our own. Point number three seems a little selfish. Point number three says, nurture your own happiness. Nurture your own happiness. But it does make sense when you start thinking about it. She says, while we can't control our children's happiness, we are responsible for our own. And because children absorb everything from us, our moods matter. Happy parents are likely to have happy kids, while children of depressed parents suffer twice the average rate of depression. Consequently, one of the best things you can do for your child's emotional well-being is to attend to yours. Carve out time for rest, relaxation, and perhaps most important, romance. By the way, Neville and I are going on a date tonight, so there we go. Hope she's paying, I don't know. Nurture your relationship with your spouse. If parents have a really good, committed relationship, the child's happiness often naturally follows. No one likes to be around Debbie Downer. If you've seen the Saturday Night Live skits, they're all talking around a table, and this Debbie Downer character always says something that just brings the whole table down. No one wants to be around that person. We have a family, used to attend church with us, they're in a different organization now. A few of you will know, so I won't say the name. But they had an entire litter of children. And one time we had one of their kids come to our house because they had their 18th child or whatever they had. And so this one, because our boys are about the same age, they stayed with us, or he stayed with us, for about 2 weeks. And my kids aren't really up or down. They just kind of enjoyed life. Well, this young man just stayed down all the time. Didn't want to do anything. Just like the Eeyore the donkey from Winnie the Pooh, just always down here. And I tell you, being around that for a couple of weeks, I started seeing my sons being that way. Just a little mopey and all that. No one likes to be around that. If your kids see that at home, they're going to feed off of that. They're going to certainly feed off of what they see at home. So we do need to have our own happiness. Even though it does seem a little bit selfish, you need to stay positive. Let's look at what God says about it. Psalm 37. When I put Debbie Downer on here, I know she's going to be mad at me, but I put Debbie, and I started to spell just because it's in my head, Haggard. And I thought, I better not do that. I'd be in trouble. I had to go back and delete and put Downer. Debbie's definitely not a downer, I'll say that. Psalm 37, verses 4 through 9. See what God says about being happy, no matter what. It says, delight yourself also in the Lord, and he shall give you the desires of your heart. Verse 5, commit your way to the Lord, trust also in him, and he shall bring it to pass. He shall bring forth your righteousness as the light, and your justice as the noonday. Rest in the Lord and wait patiently for him. Middle of verse 7, do not fret because of him who prospers in his way, because of the man who brings wicked schemes to pass. Cease from anger and forsake wrath. Do not fret, it only causes harm. Verse 9, for evildoers shall be cut off, but those who wait on the Lord, they shall inherit the earth. It may seem that people that cheat, that rob and steal, they do get their way in this life. But if we follow these verses, remember, there's nothing for us to fret about. There's nothing for us to be in a bad mood about. God's going to take care of this in his own time. Not on our time, but he will take care of it. So just remember, our families pick up on our attitudes and avoid these frustrations that it's talking about. So you don't get a promotion. Something happens at work because of a holy day or something. We're still to be positive because we're still following God. And we're going to be rewarded for that at some time. Point number 4. Praise the right stuff. Point number 4, praise the right stuff. She says, not surprisingly, studies consistently link self-esteem and happiness. Our children can't have one without the other. It's something we know intuitively, and it turns many of us into overzealous cheerleaders. Our child scribbles, and we declare him a Picasso. He scores a goal, and he's the next David Beckham, who's a world-class soccer star. He adds 1 and 2, and he's ready for the Mensa Society. But this sort of achievement and praise can backfire. The danger if this is the only kind of praise a child hears, is that he'll think he needs to achieve to win your approval. He'll become afraid that if he doesn't succeed, he'll fall off the pedestal and his parents won't love him anymore. Praising specific traits, intelligence, prettiness, athleticism can also undermine children's confidence later if they grow up believing they're valued for something that's out of their control and potentially fleeting. I'm going to read one more paragraph here. It says, if you praise your child primarily for being pretty, for example, what happens when he or she grows old and loses that beauty? How many facials will it take for her to feel worthwhile? Exactly true with that. Interestingly, this woman says, research shows that kids who are praised mainly for being bright become intellectually timid later, fearing that they will be seen as less smart and less valuable if they fail. So they've always succeeded, and they've never been told, oh, no, you didn't do that right. And then they have issues. Do not praise a child just for having a trait. Oh, you're pretty. Okay, well, have a car wreck, and then that child's not pretty anymore if they scar themselves. What kind of self-esteem is that? Proverbs 13:4. Let's look at this. Proverbs 13:4. Kind of tells you what you should praise your child for. You know, it kind of comes at a different angle. Proverbs 13:4. The soul of a lazy man desires and has nothing, but the soul of the diligent shall be made rich. You don't praise them for, oh, you know, 1 + 1. You praise them for getting it wrong 10 times and then getting it right because they continued to work. Praise them for that effort. If you're praising them because of something that really was just a trait, rather than that diligence and that effort, you may have problems in the future. You may set them up for failure, and they're going to have a big problem with figuring it out if they don't learn that early, which leads to the next point. Point 4 and point 5 are very similar. Fifth point is allow for success and failure. Allow for success and failure. And she says, of course, if you really want to bolster your child's self-esteem, focus less on compliments and more on providing him or her with ample opportunities to learn new skills. Mastery, not praise, is the real self-esteem builder. Fortunately, when it comes to little children, nearly everything they do is a chance to attain mastery. Learn to walk, crawl, even use a potty, ride a tricycle. All of that they learn. So there's a success and failure rate. Our challenge is to stand back and let our children do for themselves what they're capable of. The great mistake really good parents make is doing too much for their children. Here's a quick poem that I had to read this in eighth grade at our eighth grade graduation, if you call it that. But it's called The Man Who Thinks He Can. It says, if you think you are beaten, you are. If you think you dare not, you don't. If you'd like to win but think you can't, it's almost a sense you won't. If you think you'll lose, you've lost. For out in the world we find, success begins with a fellow's will. It's all in his state of mind. If you think you're outclassed, you are. You've got to think high to rise. You've got to be sure of yourself before you'll ever win that prize. Life's battles don't always go to the stronger or faster man. But sooner or later, the man who wins is the one who thinks he can. You don't learn that until you've failed several times. You've gotten back up. I know Clark loves this movie, but one of the Rockies, one of the last ones he talks about. Doesn't matter how many times you get knocked down. It matters that you get up each time. Every time you're down, you get back up. But we have to let our kids fail. And colleges are starting to have a tremendous issue with this. A couple of the teachers I work with, their husbands and wives are professors. And believe it or not, the parents are now coming in with the kids when their grades aren't good enough. Grown 18, 19, 20-year-old kids, their parents are coming in to see the professors because they need little Susie's grades up and they don't think it's fair anymore. And college professors are having a real issue with that. But it's happening in middle school. I'm sure, Megan, they see it in high school. And it's going on to high school. There are even instances where the parents go to the interviews now, once they've graduated with even master's degrees, to make sure that little Johnny or Susie's not offended during the interview process. We've got to learn to let our children fail. They've got to do that. Proverbs 24, verse 16. Well, this is the rocky verse. Proverbs 24, verse 16. Says, for a righteous man may fall seven times and rise again, but the wicked shall fall by calamity. Again, teach our children to fail. Then later in life, they won't have a disappointment happens. They know how to deal with it. You do see suicide rates and stuff going up when first time a kid doesn't make a baseball team. We had a little boy last year at our school. Tried to commit suicide because his little girlfriend broke off with him one night and tried to commit suicide. First time he'd ever seen failure. Fortunately, he didn't succeed. But they're not learning failure and success. They're not learning how to get back up, like it says. Point number six, give them real responsibilities when they're young. Give real responsibilities. Here's what she says. Kids as young as three can play meaningful family roles, whether it's refilling the cat's dry food bowl or setting out the napkins at dinner time. If possible, assign a role that plays to your child's strengths. For example, if your little one loves to organize things, give him or her the job of sorting the forks and spoons. If they're particularly nurturing, then their role could be entertaining baby sister while you get dinner on the table. So long as you acknowledge that they're making a contribution to the family, it will heighten your children's sense of connection and confidence, two prerequisites for lasting happiness. Giving a child the best education in the world will do them no good if they have no work ethic. You can be hired by the best firm in the world. How long are they going to keep you if you decide, first day I'll come in 3 hours late? Teach the children responsibility at the beginning, and they will have that work ethic. Some of you may agree, some may not with me. I believe a work ethic is much more important than an education level. You can have all the education in the world. If you don't get your tail out and actually bust it, it doesn't mean anything. You've got to teach children to work. 2 Thessalonians 3. 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 6 through 9. I hit my phone and I just called my wife. Oh, I apologize. It hit in my pocket. Second Thessalonians 3, if I said first. 2 Thessalonians 3, verses 6 through 9. Talking about the example they set for the people to follow. It says, but we command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ. Am I on the right? I hear a lot of people turning. 2 Thessalonians 3, verse 6 through 9. We're good. We command you, brethren, in the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you withdraw from every brother who walks disorderly and not according to the tradition which he received from us. So they set an example here. For you yourselves know how you ought to follow us, for we were not disorderly among you, nor did we eat anyone's bread free of charge, but worked with labor and toil night and day, that we might not be a burden to any of you. Not because we do not have authority, but to make ourselves an example of how you should follow us. If we're in the yard and grandkids or anyone's there, let them pick up sticks with you. Give them a job to do, even when they're a little bitty. Working on a car, although I didn't want to work with my dad. He hated cars, so he would sling wrenches all the way across the yard. So I had to duck a lot. And I picked that habit up from him, by the way. But if you're doing something, have them help you. Grandchildren, our own kids, anyone in your family, just you're spending time there. The seventh and final point is practice habitual gratitude. Practice habitual gratitude. And she says, finally, happiness studies consistently link feelings of gratitude to emotional well-being. Research at the University of California at Davis and elsewhere has shown that people who keep daily or weekly gratitude journals feel more optimistic. And we do that with cards and things like that, don't we? Make more progress toward goals and feel better about their lives overall. For a child, keeping a journal may be unrealistic, but one way to foster gratitude in children is to ask that each member of the family take time daily, before or during a meal, for example, to name aloud something he or she is thankful for. The important thing is to make it a regular ritual. This is one habit that will foster all kinds of positive emotions, and it really can lead to lasting happiness. Now, we could do that with God as well, right? Teach our children how to pray, how to thank God for everything He's given us, and also other people. If someone gives us something, not, oh, well, I deserve that, so that's fine. But also to teach them, say thank you if anyone hands you anything. We can all learn to be more thankful. Sometimes I'll think about something, I didn't even thank them for that. And so we can all learn to be that. You may have that gift where you thank people all the time. I wish I did. I don't have that. But let's go to 1 Thessalonians 5 to look at what God says about this. 1 Thessalonians 5 and verse 18. Very simple verse, but you get a lot out of this. In everything, give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus for you. In everything. And Paul talks about when you're being persecuted, give thanks that you're able to go through that. Everything we have. Teach our children to appreciate every single thing that ever happens. So, brethren, build connections. Don't try to make your child happy all the time. Nurture your own happiness. Praise the right stuff. Allow them to succeed. Allow them to fail. Give real responsibilities and practice habitual gratitude. Teach them to say thanks, and hopefully we will have a happy child.